This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Monday, time for our Zoomer Squad, and it is a special day. CARP is holding its Seniors Day of Action at Queen's Park, and the focus is on financial well-being as well as health care. Now, this follows a damning report from the Ontario Securities Commission and the Canadian Investment Regulatory Organization, which confirmed what seniors have been saying for years, that Canada's banks are putting sales targets ahead of all else. And the report reveals widespread systemic pressure by bank head offices on bank-affiliated advisors to push products, hit quotas, and keep client money inside the bank, even when that is not in the interest of their clients. Also, we always talk about problems with the healthcare system and what to do about that. And another thing, earlier this morning, the chief of the Toronto Police and Ontario's Attorney General announced some new rules on bail. Many people have been calling for that. So will that make us all more safe? A lot to talk about today. The numbers to call: 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740.
And now, time for the Zoomer Squad.
And now I'd like to welcome Anthony Quinn, president of CARP, Liz West, host of the Afternoon Express, and David Valentin, principal at Liaison Strategies. Anthony, big day for you. You've scooched back here in a suit and tie. That's how I know it's a very special day.
Glad to be back, Libby. We were at Queen's Park this morning giving a media opportunity to talk about our Seniors Day of Action at Queen's Park. CARP is back at Queen's Park in person, en masse, for the first time since the pandemic. So we're delighted to be back at Queen's Park. We're bringing these two important messages to our MPPs across the province. One is that the healthcare system really is not prepared in any way for the imminent aging of Ontario's population. So we've known about it for decades, but the situation is at a crisis level for those who are in it now, but those numbers will continue to increase in the next 5 to 10 years. And if we don't fix it now, we'll all be living in an emergency situation. And the other issue, as you mentioned, Libby, is that big banks are, I would say, exploiting their customer base when it comes to providing their financial advice. It is a closed shop. The banks are promoting only their own funds, which can lead to a conflict, and Canadians are not getting the best possible return on their investments, and they don't know it. So I want to talk a bit about that report from the Securities Commission.
Well, absolutely. David, is that something that is on people's radar? I mean, big banks, Canadians love their big banks, and they're pretty secure because they're very conservative. But this is something, and I've noticed big banks kind of pushing stuff more, even on people who are not seniors.
Well, this is, I think, part of the issue, which is that there's a lot of confidence in the major banks and in these big financial institutions. And so you are expecting them to have your best interest at heart and to give you honest advice. And as Anthony mentioned, we're learning from the report that's not the case. That's not what's taking place. And in a lot of situations, there's either a conflict or at least the appearance of a conflict in a lot of cases. So I think this is something that has to be addressed. And I saw part of the CARP press conference early this morning. I thought you guys did a great job. But, some of these questions now, and how are we going to protect seniors and people really all across the board, though it's impacting seniors more heavily, of course. These are important questions, and we have to have real answers from policymakers.
The issue, David, the younger generation has this long investment horizon where they will continue to lose money compounding over years. So it's an issue for younger Canadians as well. And for older adults who have their life savings with the banks, they have this shorter window. And every day that they're not getting the best advice or being placed in the best products for them, they're losing the chance to increase their savings, their nest egg, and live longer with dignity. The most damning thing in that report, Libby, was that almost 25% of the in-branch advisors admitted that they recommend products that aren't in their clients' best interest, at least sometimes. So that's...
Hey, Daisy, stop! Daisy! There's Daisy. Liz. I was just going to bring Liz in the conversation. And Liz, I remember way back when we were both at Citi and I was the money specialist, one of the things that I used to say that, you know, people don't necessarily like to follow was that if you really want the best financial advice for you, you have to pay for it. Like, you go to a financial advisor that you pay for advice as opposed to the bank or the mutual fund company paying them, because then kind of what do you expect? But this is still quite disappointing.
Yeah, first of all, what you said is exactly right. And that's why I just made a move from a bank this year. It took me, I don't know, a good 5+ years to convince my husband it was okay to do. And he's in his early 60s. My mother, on the other hand, and I just took her to her bank branch on Saturday because she had some documents to sign, has complete faith in her bank. She wouldn't dream of not thinking that bank has her best interest in mind and that it's the safest place to put her money. So to find out that that it's not the case, and of course, you know, the sales and the quotas are the exact things I was worried about. That is exactly why this CARP report, or what the CARP action is so important, because we need some truth and honesty. And I think that's what it will take for seniors to wake up to the fact that their trusted institutions that they their whole lives have believed in might not appear to be as faithful to them as they are to the bank.
You know, Anthony, you mentioned younger generations, but I think they are more drawn to, you know, the online financial institutions. And you know those ads saying, gee, like, you don't want to, you're not going to dad's old guy. And the other thing I'll say about the banks is that historically, especially older people would have relationships, long-standing relationships. What I find, and I don't do that much with the bank, I do a little bit, is that from one time to the next, I'll find somebody I think is pretty good and competent, and the next time I call them, they're gone, and there's somebody else. And the last time, and I get cold calls from people who want my investments, and the last time I said, you know, I looked at a statement, and I saw a new annoying charge for $2.25 a month that I don't even know why it's there, but take it off. And the guy said, I am powerless to take this off. And I said, well, why would I invest money with you if you can't deal with $2.25?
Well, in the larger picture, Canadians are completely trusting of their institutions. The banks are trusted by younger and older Canadians alike. David might have more numbers on that, but the 15 to 34-year-olds report that they have high trust in the banks. Now, paying for advice is one of the things we're talking about, Libby. If you walk into your local bank branch and get advice for mutual funds, you're going to be offered a very small shelf of bank-owned products. If you walk across to the same bank's wealth division across the street, you're going to get access to all the products and all their best advice because of how you're deemed to be a wealthy investor. So we think that The banks should be treating all of their clients equally. They should be giving them the best advice and the best options for their greatest investment returns. And we want to bring this to the attention of investors, of Ontarians today and Canadians nationally. And we're not asking everyone to take their money out of the banks. We think the banks should act in their clients' best interest first and foremost. If it takes regulatory changes, bring it on. If it takes government policy changes, bring it on. But our letter to Anthony Ostler, the head of the Canadian Bankers Association today, we're putting it back on them saying it's time to rebuild that trust and give Canadians the best interest standard they deserve.
Well, and the other thing I'm a little confused about is that, you know, we often laugh at those American ads that say we're a fiduciary. And I thought, well, you're all a fiduciary, but I think that there's a slightly lower bar.
There is
here.
It's a suitability standard.
Right.
So that's how the banks or any other investment advisor has the opportunity to say, well, I thought this was a suitable investment, but how suitable is it for you versus how much of a commission does it pay me, or how many tick boxes on my quota for my branch manager or my district manager have I checked to improve my remuneration? So the suitability standard is such a low bar that CARP has been advocating for at least a fiduciary standard, if not a higher version of a suitability standard as it is today.
David, is this on people's radar?
It's not. There's a lot of concern about cybercrime. There's a lot of concern about Bitcoin for people who are interested in Bitcoin. A lot of people still don't understand what it is. And you see in younger Canadians, you know, who have a different relationship with banks, they don't know their teller. They don't have necessarily someone in the branch who is assigned to them. In many cases, they don't, you know, in work we've done, they don't know what their home branch is. They're not even cognizant of that. So they are sort of experimenting with banking in a different way. But even so, when you ask Canadians across the board, you know, where is the place to hold your money? Yeah, you'll have investments. Maybe you have some Bitcoin, but where should your serious money go? Where people have the most confidence that they're not going to be scammed or the money's going to be misplaced is these big Canadian banks. And there's some knowledge about the fact that your accounts are insured. So if something were to happen, the government would backstop. There's some knowledge about that. Not as high as I think maybe the banks would like to have it. But there's this sense that, you know, if you're with one of the big six banks in Canada, you're probably covered. Things are probably fine. And every so often, you know, we'll see stories on the news that tell us, okay, there's been an issue here or there. But by and large, high degrees of confidence, which is why I think these practices, you know, could be seen as very predatory, because they're taking that trust and confidence and using it to sell their mutual funds.
Well, exactly. That's a big deal, Liz. I'm surprised it took you so long to convince Scott.
I know, because, listen, I used to work for a bank when I was young. I was a teller. And so I was raised on the banking system. It's funny, we were just talking. I actually, when I was talking to my mom on the weekend, she said, well, I've got some riffs in one bank and your dad's riffs were in another bank. And I said, well, Mom, so this is the problem. Now we're stuck and we've got to get forms, you know, filled out to transfer. I said, why did you put your money in that bank and his money in the other bank? She said, well, because there is a guarantee if the banks go under, the government guarantees. She thought it was like $100,000 in savings if that should happen. And I thought, well, that's the mentality, you know, growing up in the war, feeling insecure, terrified if your money's not in the most conventional source for savings and investment. And that is a mindset that's near impossible to change, especially as you age. She's 90. So to me, it's criminal that the banks, knowing that the older generation has the most money invested, that they're looking out for their own interests. It doesn't surprise me. My 19-year-old is highly skeptical of banks and would think, would probably more happily put money, if he had any, somewhere else. But he, on the other hand, has a completely polar opposite viewpoint that the banks are, you know, self-serving, only in it for themselves. So it's really interesting to see, especially as the parent who's in between the two.
Well, a couple of interesting things, and I'm talking here because many years as the money specialist. So number one, our banks are safer, and it doesn't go back to the Depression. I mean, think back to the financial crisis of 08 here, and there were American banks that went under, and our big banks, which are properly capitalized and have conservative levels of reserves, are safer. And the other thing about, you refer to some version, deposit insurance covers each instrument. So it's up to a certain amount that you're insured by the Canada Deposit Insurance Corporation.
For your cash, but not for your investments. So
not for investments, yes. but for, you know, GICs or whatever they are. Yeah.
You're correct, Libby. The Canadian banks are well-established and trustworthy institutions, but they have very little competition.
Yes, and that's the drawback.
And that's the drawback. The competition for investors is outside of the banks at present, and that's where CARP is working to press the federal government to look at this issue as well when it comes to competition and access, and for the provincial government to make sure that the securities regulator is actually doing the regulating. If in their own report they can point to the fact that Canadian investment advisors are not acting in their clients' best interest, that's beyond a red flag. And we don't want to have years and years of back and forth and maybe some minor changes occur after everyone forgets about it. So we're calling on the banks to act first, and we're going to Queen's Park today to make sure that they do.
And what do you think the chances of that are?
Well, the next step, Libby, if we don't get cooperation from the banks and we don't get political action, then CARP talks to our members and seniors across the country and saying, well, if the banks aren't going to protect you, you have to protect yourself. And then it's where should you go with your money rather than getting the banks to change.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, you also want to talk about healthcare. And I have to say, you know, we see in dribs and drabs, the government addressing some of the shortfalls in healthcare. You know, we get an allocation here and there for another Ontario health team, and we get notices about numbers of nurses being hired. But it's still kind of a drop in the bucket given the level, the shortfalls that we have.
In 2021, there were 1.1 million seniors, 75 plus in Canada, in Ontario. So 75 and older in 2021, 1.1 million. In 2035, there will be 2 million. So we're looking at 1 million Ontarians over age 75. And the system is already cracking. This will be the biggest pressure to hit our system, and it's coming in the next 5 to 7 years. So long-term care plans that are in the process now and beds that are being built won't meet the current demand, let alone the coming demand.
And they're not meeting their own targets in terms of building long-term care. David, I'm curious about, again, the perception of that, you know. During the pandemic, when we all saw the horrible situation inside our long-term care homes, there was a vow we were going to fix it. And now nobody's looking at this. Nobody seems interested. We've seen corporatization of long-term care homes, drop in standards, and the government is not meeting its own targets.
Well, we actually took a look at this over the summer in one of our public releases, which was the perception of construction versus what's actually taking place. And if you're following construction news carefully or you're an avid news reader, you'll know housing starts are down, the long-term care home builds are down. They're not meeting targets for anything. And yet, you know, if you ask people, you know, is there construction going on in and around your neighborhood? Is there construction going on in the province, they'll say, yes, there is. And in fact, you know, there's more construction than before for a large subset of the population. So that's why I think, you know, you see the government sort of, you know, getting away with this, where they're not being burned by this record as much as they could be, which is that even though the starts have fallen for residential, for long-term care, you name it, people still see a lot of cranes in the sky. And the impression is that stuff is still getting built. So that news hasn't really hit people yet.
And we're going to get to this later in the show, but a lot of those cranes are doing nothing, nada, except clogging up the streets. And Liz, you are so fortunate that your mom is not in a long-term care home. But do you feel there are enough supports for her to remain as she is?
Yeah, great question. So she's in a retirement home. I'm in the midst of looking for somewhere that has assisted living. My dad was in long-term care. He had dementia and needed, you know, that extra support. I'm starting out in my big research project. I'm a little nervous about how hard it's going to be for me to figure out what's available to her. And of course, you know, the biggest challenge around care for when you need assisted living or long-term is just, is there a bed available? Because you're literally waiting for someone else to pass away before you can get it. So it's like, if you don't take it right away, it's like daycare. You can't pre-book. Like, I'm going to need it, so I need to pre-book it. You have to need it right away, take it right away. I think it's highly challenging. And when the government's only looking at their four-year forecast because they want to stay elected, they're gonna address the squeaky wheel and not the something that's going to not, you know, give them an immediate bump in their numbers. So this is the kind of thing that can keep rolling over to the next government, the next government, the next government. And if it's not for CARP, then who's going to be out fighting the good fight?
And Anthony, you have aging parents as well.
My dad is currently in a long-term care home and my mom is in assisted living. The spaces available for these folks in their 80s and 90s now is one thing. What's going to happen in the next 5 years is what is going to be the crisis that everyone will understand. We have 300,000 Ontarians right now with some form of dementia. That's going to go to 500,000 by 2030. Wow. So the dementia increase is coming along with the baby boomer wave of aging Ontarians who are going to need more and more care as they age. The care system is not designed for this immediate wave. So we're going to Queen's Park today to say once and for all, this is not a partisan issue. This is something that everyone must address. I would call it a warlike effort, Libby. And I'm envisioning, you know, those empty Hudson Bay stores that we see in the shopping malls across the province being filled with patients in the not too distant future. That's how serious of an issue this is.
There's an idea.
Well, the infrastructure can't be built. We need people to be cared for in their own homes as much as possible. We need as much prevention as possible so that our own children and our younger Ontarians are not stuck in this ER line where no one gets care, because there's going to be more people over age 75. There's going to be more falls. There's going to be more broken hips. There's going to be more surgeries. And the system will be bottlenecked so tightly that everyone will suffer.
Yeah. So again, you know, what, you know, how would you grade the provincial government? And again, it's so hard when they make these little announcements. You know, there's this here and that there, and it's kind of hard to put it all together and figure out what they're doing.
It is, and I don't know if it's an issue for this provincial government or previous leaders. Everyone has kicked the can down the road. None of these statistics are unknown to elected officials, but we continue to elect folks, and they manage to get by on not doing the things they have to do. It's no longer appropriate or even feasible to kick it further down the road. Otherwise, we'll have Hudson's Bay stores full of stretchers.
Okay.
I'm really, that's how much of a crisis we're at now, Libby.
Okay. We're just about ready to wrap things up. Liz, what would you like to leave us with on this?
I'm just picturing myself in the Hudson's Bay at the moment because, like, I'm a little worried about me. And, you know, like, you make a great point about the fact that it's like, it's not to, like, we all don't feel the pain of the challenges around where we can move to when we do have to move out of our home. But it will get to that point. And that's really worrisome. And I wish there was a way somehow everybody could understand what it's going to feel like. And it's always bothersome to me when we have statistics and we can literally map it. I could map it on ChatGPT right now if I wanted. Map me what the, you know, the population, like the information's right there. And it's really frustrating if we don't get a grip on this and take the action that Anthony outlined. So I'm frustrated. That's my last word.
Okay. And last 20 seconds to David. So how do we get this, you know, more on the radar of the public?
I think people just have to speak up. And I think that's why it's so important that CARP is doing that work today at Queen's Park. But, you know, everyone should feel free to call their MPP and say, hey, what are you doing about this? And it's only when politicians think it's a real live issue for voters that they're going to take serious action.
Okay, last word to you, Anthony.
We've been telling our members to call their MPP to make sure they come down and see us today at Queen's Park this afternoon. So I'd ask all your listeners to call their own MPPs now and say CARP is at Queen's Park today. Go down and get the message.
Okay. On that note, we wrap things up and congratulations on an excellent day of action. And there's more to come. Thanks for it, Anthony Quinn, Liz West, and David Valentin.
Thanks very much, Libby.
Okay.
Thanks, Libby.
Thank you. We are taking a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about a very local fight. And residents are banding together to save a very beloved plaza, which has been a meeting place for decades at Lawrence and Bathurst in Toronto. And we'll check in on how that's going and why it's important when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, now to a very local story that has a neighborhood coming together to try to save a beloved neighborhood plaza that is a gathering place for many residents. The place in question is Lawrence Plaza, and it's slated for redevelopment if plans by RioCan, which owns and manages the historic plaza, and Milestone Group are approved. Now, one of the landmarks in that plaza is the United Bakers Dairy Restaurant. CEO Nathan Ladovsky joins me now, along with Councillor Mike Cole, who is on the line from Israel. Both of you, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Libby. It's a pleasure to be on with you.
I'm here in Jerusalem, yeah.
Okay, well, let's begin with Nathan. United Bakers Dairy Restaurant is a landmark. And so what have you been hearing from your customers? What are your feelings about the possibility of this being redeveloped?
Well, Libby, thank you very much for having us on, both Mike and I. We've been hearing a lot from our customers ever since the first article on BlogTO broke. Everyone's wondering what we're going to do. And what I can say is that we're in talks with the developers right now to realize a position in the new development, while simultaneously we're exploring all options that exist in the area. But I want to say to the people of Toronto, rest assured that United Bakers will continue to operate just as we have for 113 years.
Mike, why is it so important to save this particular plaza? It's one of the oldest suburban plazas. It has a very different kind of a footprint than the modern ones. What are the things that you're worried about that affect the neighborhood in general?
Well, the plaza is really it's a cherished local destination for your everyday needs. You know, if you want to go to the drugstore, you want to go get some tests done, medical tests done, you want to pick up some discount clothing, you want to pick up some bagels. You know, it's all there. Plus, the banks are there. And people can walk there easily. They can go there in their strollers, or you can drive there. So it's really an anchor, not only for the immediate community, but it's an anchor really for people who have grown up there and come back there from all parts of the GTA and beyond.
And what do you worry that could happen to the neighborhood if this redevelopment goes ahead?
Well, one of the big concerns raised by the residents is that there's already a serious congestion traffic problem there, because it's really in the Allen Road, that there's 401 triangle, where everybody's trying to get to the Allen, everybody's trying to get up to the 401. So we've already got, you know, hyper gridlock there most of the time. So if you add, you know, another approximately 3,000 residential units, condos, whatever there, it's going to mean people with more cars. It's going to mean more deliveries by Amazon. It's Uber, Eats, et cetera. Plus, you know, people that might drive there to shop if the retail is retained. So it's not really workable, sustainable in terms of all these people, all these cars, all this traffic. And we're saying, you know, tone it down. We don't need eight towers, you know. Maybe have some mid-rise in there. You know, we don't need 40-story towers. That's the main message people are trying to get across.
The only thing I'd add, you said the area is congested. The entire city is congested. And, you know, this is a proposed big development, and a lot of them are not happening. We're going to get to that in the next segment of the show. I mean, we have, you know, plans afoot for yet another huge development that I'm not sure people want. I mean, Nathan, I'm glad to hear that whatever happens, United Bakers Dairy Restaurant will still be with us. But what do you think you lose by changing the scale of things there?
Well, our primary concern is ensuring that the new development truly serves the people of this amazing neighborhood. We as a restaurant represent a longstanding community fixture, and our continued presence is vital for maintaining the local character and services that residents rely on. And we're not opposed to change. We know the change is inevitable. You got 5 hectares in the middle of the city. Our province needs housing. We are not opposed to that. We welcome the opportunity for change. We just, as the Councillor Cole said, want to make sure it's mindful of the needs of the community. We're hopeful that the developer will recognize the irreplaceable value established by the local businesses and commit to a plan that ensures not only our stability, but that the development must be built with the community and not over it. They are proposing 3,000 units, rental units. Quite a few of them are proposed to be 2- and 3-bedroom units, which is going to lead to immense density in an already heavily trafficked area. They're proposing 1,000 parking spots. There's currently 600 parking spots at Lawrence Plaza. And if you come here on a Saturday or Sunday, you'll see that they're almost all taken up. So with the addition of an additional minimum 3,000 residents and only 400 more parking spaces compared to what we currently have, it's going to lead to a gridlock nightmare. We don't want another Yonge and Eglinton. We don't want a Yonge and Sheppard. I'm saying this not as a business operator, but as someone who was born on Glencairn, raised on Old Orchard, has grown up and worked in the area all my life. I want to make sure that our city remains livable, and I see this development in its current state as making it a little bit more difficult for residents of the area. And that, for us, is a major concern.
Mike, again, what kind of influence can you have? This is, after all, a private developer. But, again, there are a number of developments, that even ones that already have permission, that are on hold, either because buyers aren't interested or also because the city is taking another look at some of the zoning.
Well, yeah, this is the curious thing is that, as you know, the condo market has collapsed, even the rental market. We've got some empty rental buildings now that have gone up because the rents are too high. So, but they're, you know, coming forth with this plan, proposal, and, you know, we just want to ensure that this proposal, if and when it happens, that is sustainable, that is reasonable, and there, you know, and maybe include some housing for seniors in the proposal, because these are all going to be market rents, et cetera, which, you know, are not really within reach of a lot of the, you know, seniors especially, and middle-income people. So we want to say, you know, have people come in, but again, don't overwhelm the neighborhood, because right now the neighborhood is, you know, at a tipping point, because we already have condos just behind, and we have, you know, rental buildings on the south side. We've got a lot of density there right now. And so, yeah, more density, but it's got to be measured in terms of what the infrastructure can take. You know, what the community center that we need there. You know, we need a place for kids. We have a lot of kids in the area because we got 14, for instance, Jewish day schools there. With the kids all over the place in their scooters, walking to school, et cetera. So they're worried. I mean, the principals of the local schools are really concerned about the impact of this type of extreme density in this at this corner.
Well, yeah, I mean, again, one of the things that I always shake my head at is when I see the mayor and other city officials, anytime we hear about developments like this, saying, yay, affordable housing. Well, the housing in the fancy new developments is not going to be affordable, Mike. I mean, I don't see how that happens.
No, absolutely, because, you know, the labor costs are still high, the land costs are high, you know, the cost of money is such. So that's the other real sore point here is, yeah, people are saying build the housing, but it's got to be housing that, not all of it, because we understand the financial pressures the developer might have, but at least some of it should be made reasonable for, as I said, even the seniors market. But again, the other thing is that we also think this proposal just calls for a minor, what they call, zoning change, you know. But we think this, and we're in a serious discussion with developers, that this is not a proper application. It should be a much higher threshold, and we're saying it should call for an official plan amendment. And so we've already, our staff at the city have already told the developer, listen, this is not properly before us because it's not a minor change here. It's a major official plan amendment. So we're in these kinds of discussions with them, and hopefully they'll listen, because, you know, the thing about it is, you know, we had a couple hundred people there protesting the other day, but not protesting, but saying, we love this plaza. I've been at this development situation many years, but I've never seen such passion. I mean, people were almost in tears. This is how they relate to this place, because it's not just another place to shop. It's really a family place, it's a meeting place, an eating place. And that's, if you don't live in the area, you've never gone to Lawrence Plaza, it's really a real family experience there. It's more than a place where you just get, you know, your groceries. It's a place where you actually see people you knew years ago, or your neighbor is there, and you talk to them, you go there on your stroller, or you drive. So it's quite a unique part of Toronto, and we lose this. We really lose the heart and soul in the middle of the city.
Absolutely. The other question is, like, assume that this gets approved. How long a construction is going to be there? And you know, is it just going to be like a great big hole with nowhere to go for, I would imagine, you know, multiple years? Mike, do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, well, you know, the developer, to their credit, they're serious people, you know, RioCan, they're serious people. You know, they would phase it in. But even with the phase in, you're going to have dump trucks in and out of there. You're going to have cement trucks. You're going to have front-end loaders. You're going to have dust. You're going to have noise. And sure, they might say it'll take a year or whatever. It always takes three times whatever the estimate is. So that's the other impact. Even though, you know, there's plans about phasing, there's always a huge impact on the existing small businesses there and the existing neighborhood, because trucks have got to get in and out of there with their loads of concrete, et cetera.
Nathan, do you have a sense of how long the disruption would last?
I think that there'd be a lot of benefit to the developers communicating a bit more clearly their expectations of a timeline. We haven't received it as a tenant in the plaza. And I can tell you from being intimately familiar with the boilers and the plumbing in the plaza, this is a very complex plaza. It is kind of old. And I think that as they go to, as they start whatever the plans are for development, they'll realize that there's a lot of interconnected utilities that run through the entirety of the plaza. And I'm curious to see what plans they have to minimize the disruption to the local community.
Well, it's hard to imagine how that would happen. And I've seen smaller redevelopments, and the timeline is in the years, not a year. Mike, what would you like to leave us with on this?
Well, I just think, I just hope that the developer in this case doesn't bypass the city and the local residents and appeal this directly to the provincial government's Ontario Land Tribunal, which rubber stamps all development. So we're still counting on their good graces to say, listen, keep working with us, keep working with the city, and let's come up with something that is a win-win situation rather than this really over-the-top proposal, which I think is not good in the long run.
Okay. On that note, we wrap things up. Guys, please keep us apprised on what is sure. happening with this. Thanks so much, Nathan Ladovsky.
One more thing, Libby. The community has rallied together. There's a website, SaveLawrencePlaza.ca. And I think it's important that anybody who wants to have their voice heard, this is the place to do it. SaveLawrencePlaza.ca for the petition.
Okay, Nathan. And Mike, thank you for that. And keep us apprised on what's going on. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Libby.
Okay, we're taking another break. And when we come back, we're going to look at the context of the condo market. I mean, Michael referred to it collapsing. I don't know if it's quite that dire, but driving around the city, you see projects that have been paused, and they're just an eyesore hole in the ground, clogging things up more than they are. So we're going to talk about that when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, while residents in the Lawrence and Bathurst area are fighting a proposed development, many of our streets seem to be clogged with condo construction sites that have been paused. And they've been paused largely because of market conditions, but there are also some other factors involved. And I, for one, would like to get to the bottom of this, the numbers, 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-740-4740. And now I'm joined by Andrew St. George, who is a managing partner of St. George Property Management, and Devel Morrison, who is with Bossley Real Estate. Thanks so much. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, Devel.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Give me a sense. The counselor, Mike Cole, in the last segment referred to a collapse of the condo market. Is it quite that dire? And again, why are we seeing projects that have started and seem to have stopped?
Well, I think that before we say collapse of the condo market, we need to say pre-construction condo market. So I think that it's good to put that qualifier on it.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, because of the economics aren't working, as they say, the math isn't mathing. So you do have a lot of projects that have stopped. The ones that are continuing to build are certainly continuing to build. But if we look towards, let's say, 2029, we're most likely not going to have any new condo projects delivering.
So when you say the math is not mathing, how so? What's not working out?
Well, I mean, essentially, as any business, whether you're a developer or you own a bake store, you need to make a profit. And so if you simply can't make a profit, then you simply can't continue to do business. So when it comes to the developers, they're looking at, by the time they pay the development charges to the city, by the time they pay the other taxes, and, you know, just an FYI, pre-construction condos are taxed at about 30% of what they're paying is taxes. By the time they pay their construction costs and, you know, any other fees, and by the time they charge the consumer what they need to charge them, the math just doesn't make any sense anymore. And just to give you an example, for the last few years, let's say last year, you could buy a resale condo at about $1,000 per square foot, but a pre-construction condo was going to cost you between $1,400 and $1,600 per square foot. And now we've seen those prices come down, but the pre-construction condo market still has not come down to where the resale condo market is.
And how big a factor are interest rates?
Interest rates are definitely a factor. They've definitely come down. But a lot of that pre-construction condo market was driven by investors, and not just the foreign investors that people like to make out as a boogeyman, but I would say the domestic investors. You know, if you start speaking to your neighbors, you'll find out how many of them actually own condos downtown that they rent out. And so, you know, the challenge with the pre-construction condo market right now is that if you're an investor, it's not going to cash flow positive. By the time you pay for the condo, by the time you pay for your property taxes and your maintenance fees and you collect your rent, you're probably $1,000 a month in the hole, which is why for the last couple of years, you've got investors who have sold their condos, and they're not buying any new ones. So, you know, the pre-construction condo market is also on hold, not only because the developers can't build, but because they can't generate sales. If they have a condo project, for example, the bank requires them to sell at least 70% of those units before they'll release the financing. And there was recently a project, I believe, by the Cloverdale Mall. I think they said they'd only sold 5% of the units, so they had to cancel it.
Andrew St. George, I'd like your perspective on this again. I think that's a big factor of selling the condos before getting financing.
Yeah, well, we're noticing a lot in the after sale market. The resales, we're not seeing as much. We haven't seen as much in the last 5 months. I'd say the market's severely taken a nosedive when it comes to condos. You got to understand, when you're buying a condo, it's not just the mortgage that you have to pay for. There's also condo fees. And with the economics being the way that they are right now, adding an extra $500 to $1,500 in condo fees for the average homeowner is a little bit much for them to handle from what I'm hearing from a lot of prospective buyers.
But answer me this. If the developers need to sell before they get their financing, but they start constructing, I mean, why are we seeing, Andrew, these abandoned projects?
I don't work with a lot of the developers directly on that, but I do know from previous experience with that, a lot of it is, you know, people like the tangibles and they like to see what's there. When they're purchasing something, especially something like a home that's, something that they're going to live in and is most people's biggest asset that they're going to own. But again, going back to the other point, a lot of this and a lot of condos recently we've been noticing have been a lot of investment properties. There's been a lot of people buying as investments. There's been a lot of foreign ownership. Regardless, that is still a large part of the market. And we've noticed in recent months that that's been drying up. So I can only speculate that basically a lot of people have been, a lot of these developers have started the sales, started the construction based on pre-sales, and then people have been backing out of the sales of the units.
Is that what you're finding, DeVille?
Let's say, I would just add, most developers don't build until they can get that 70% threshold because they can't afford to finance it on their own. What you do have is some developers who are declaring bankruptcy. So when you see a site that has, you know, let's say someone has already started doing the excavation process and it's partly built and nobody's building anymore, that's someone who's gone into receivership. And, you know, with a lot of the projects that have been canceled, I would say almost a third of those are projects that are going to get resold to somebody else or that have gone into receivership. So if we take, for example, the One Bloor Street West, the Sam Mizrahi project,
yeah,
that one went into receivership. They had to resell it. So essentially, Tridel was asked to take over the building of that because Tridel could do that. But then now, you know, they've gone to court and Tridel is actually refunding the money of the people who actually purchased the condos in that building. So the people who purchased years ago that thought they were going to get this condo at 1 Bloor Street West, Tridel and partners have basically said, you know what, here's your money back with interest. We got to go in a different direction.
Wow. I mean, that whole saga is I think a cautionary note. I'm just looking at the clock. We don't have too much time left. This is, what about, in previous years, foreign investors, foreign students living in the condos, you know, while they were becoming an investment, we have fewer foreign students. Again, Devel, how much of a factor is that? And what about the size of the condos?
I don't think that the lack of foreign students has been a huge factor. It's interesting. I'm also a landlord myself. So although I don't rent out a condo, I have a duplex that I rent out. So I've certainly seen a difference in the demand for people looking to rent a place. But even if I look back to 2 years ago, it wasn't foreign students who were looking to rent my place. They were just people that worked here. So there have been so many more rental buildings that have gone up. So I would say the rental demand has changed. Now, your other question about the size of the condo units, I mean, that's a whole other conversation where everybody talks about we need to see more three-bedroom condos. But here's the challenge. A three-bedroom condo is most likely at least 900 or 1,000 or more square feet. Something like that is going to cost somebody $1 million, $1.2 million, $1.5 million. If you have to spend over $1 million on a condo, you're probably just going to go buy a house. Because there are houses that you can buy in Toronto for that price. So that's the challenge number one with the larger condo idea. The other challenge is that because the developers have to sell 70% of their units before the financing is released, most people who buy three-bedroom condos want to see it first before they buy. They will not buy off land. So there's a bit of a challenge with the whole size versus what people actually want and what makes financial sense.
Well, this is a fascinating conversation. I'm looking at the clock. We're out of time. Thank you so much, Devel Morrison. And sorry.
Andrew St. George.
And Andrew St. George, thank you very much for that. And I'm sure we'll be revisiting this topic once again. Bye-bye.
Beautiful. Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right. That is all the time we have for Fight Back with Libby Znaimer for today. Follow us on Instagram. Follow us on YouTube. I'll be back here tomorrow and we will talk then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.